This is the story of the trumpet, in the words of those who play it. Young or old, professional or amateur, you've never missed a day of practice, or maybe you're coming back to rediscover the joy you once knew playing your trumpet. For those who love and are fascinated with this crazy instrument that no one can seem to master, or is foolish enough to admit it if they have, this show covers all of the trumpet dynamics. Welcome to the show, everybody. This is James Newcomb, and I'm glad you're here. This episode is with Chris Coletti, formerly of the Canadian Brass, and now he's teaching at Ithaca College in upstate New York. And I actually recorded this with the intention of posting it on a different podcast that was more general interest, like musicians, non-musicians could get a lot out of it. I was really ignoring my own advice that I give to other people who are in the podcasting industry or are getting into podcasting. And that advice is to niche down. And I guess it was just a period of time where I was just experimenting. Well, thankfully for me and my wallet, I came to my senses and realized that there is a lot of power in focusing on one specific niche, and hence this podcast. But the stuff that Chris and I talked about was, quite frankly, very relevant to trumpet players. Huh, go figure. Two trumpet players talking about trumpet. I guess it's been known to happen. So even though the topic or the discussion was intended for more of a general interest audience, it was very trumpet-centric. So it's very appropriate that it goes on this podcast. So hope you enjoy it. And I am cutting to a part of the interview where it's focused solely on trumpet. I didn't want to waste your time with a bunch of stuff like Chris explaining what a brass quintet is. I think we all know what a brass quintet is. So to be respectful for your time, I'm just cutting to the point where we're talking about his time with the Canadian Brass. Well, you made some pretty significant contributions to it during your time with the group.
Thank you.
I guess arrangements and opera singing, that was pretty, it was unheard of before you came along.
That's true. So those that don't know, I have a very high, well, you can probably hear that I don't have a particularly low voice, but when I speak, but I have an operatic singing voice that is not only been pretty fun to use on stage, but that's how I met my wife.
Singing opera?
Well, we met at a gig, not Canadian Brass related, and in the show afterwards, in the meal afterwards, I did my mating call, which at the time was I sang the Queen of the Night aria. For those that don't know it, it's a very, very famous, very high aria from an opera by Mozart, and apparently she was very impressed. And so then I pulled out my second move, which was that I whistled the E major partita, the third violin partita by Bach. And that's another piece that if you don't know, it's worth a Google. It's very beautiful. All right. Bach actually used it many times in his life. That was his kind of the last version of it. And that's how we met.
Wait, you sang the Queen of the Night aria?
Correct.
The whole thing?
Well, the high part.
The whole thing is high. What are you talking about?
The whole thing is high, but yeah, it goes up to that. My voice has since changed since I've had my two boys. My voice has dropped slightly. Unfortunately, it doesn't reflect in my speaking voice. But can you hear me okay? There's a huge lawnmower passing by.
Oh, it's fine. It's all good. I mean, I can sort of hear it, but it doesn't sound like a lawnmower. It just sounds like this little hum.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, so I can't sing it anymore, but I can whistle it for you. Can I do that for the audience?
Let's hear it.
And I would sing that at a bar or whatever, and that's how I would sort of eliminate the woman that would or wouldn't be interested in me.
What was your career aspiration before you got the Canadian Brass gig?
Well, as a young trumpeter, I always wanted to be a soloist. And then through school, through conservatory, I realized that a trumpet soloist doesn't really exist as a full-time job, especially in the States. And I really fell in love with orchestral literature. And I just, like most conservatory brass players, just saw that as the kind of like the thing to strive for. And I'm actually in Alabama right now, in Huntsville, Alabama, which is because I'm playing with the symphony here. And my first job, my first successful audition was to win the principal trumpet job here. And it was just like a dream come true. I was still a student. I was in my second year of my master's at Juilliard, and I won this position, and it was a huge confidence boost. And I came to know the orchestra as, like, even though they're not super well known, they're unusual in that they fly people in for the orchestra. So it's sort of got this sort of unusual clout for a relatively small town and a small city. And people from all over the country come and play, and they do huge rep. And we have an incredible music director, and we had one then as well. And I thought that was it. And then less than a year later, I joined Canadian Brass, and suddenly the orchestral thing kind of got a backseat. Fortunately, my contract was such that it allowed for that, and they were very willing to let me sort of play what I could. And I'm glad also that I didn't wind up leaving the group, which is something that I'm sure was probably in the back of people's minds, wondering why I wouldn't just quit this orchestra job. But anyway, so now I'm back and I'm doing all the concerts.
How many concerts per year?
It's about 14. So it's not a lot.
Yeah. It's kind of part-time.
Kind of part-time and a perfect compliment, you know, to people that have a teaching job or anything else. Actually, our bass trombone player until a few years ago was also the principal bass trombone player of the New York City Ballet.
Oh, wow.
It was a totally, you know, much more busy season, and he was still able to make it work for a while.
Well, it's got to be a boon for the Huntsville Symphony. Who's ever heard of the Huntsville Symphony Orchestra? They've got a member of the Canadian Brass as one of their trumpet players. It's good publicity for them.
I hope so. I hope well, that was...
As long as you represent yourself well.
Right. I hope that... And that might be one of the reasons I didn't get fired, even though I was barely here for the last 10 years, but I'm back now. So I'm really glad that they were very supportive of that, of me accepting that position when it happened. And so I'm glad that I get to come back and, you know, give them the time that I basically always had been promising.
I've always wanted to know, what's life like at Juilliard?
So it's hyper-focused, you know, they don't tell you this, but it's more like trade school. Like, I didn't go to, I've never been to school for welding, let's say, but like when you go to school for welding, you're not taking history classes as much as you are really focusing on all the skills and knowledge that are going to make you really good at that skill. And so Juilliard is basically that, and you're learning a lot of things, but it's all to make sure that you are equipped to work and as a musician. And nowadays, at least when I was there, and I think it's still the case, specifically how to win an orchestral audition, because that was sort of the goal of most of the people there. And it's very heavily weighted, so that's what you spend your time doing.
So it's like destination is that it's an orchestra.
For a trumpeter, that's basically that's sort of your only path. I mean, unless you make up your own path, which is becoming more of a thing that universities are teaching, because it's sort of become something that we've been denying as in institutions, but you have to make your own path. There is no path. I mean, winning an orchestral audition job is like having going to school to get into the NBA. You might, but if you don't, then that's the only training you have, that you're not really set up for success outside of that one narrow goal. So entrepreneurship skills are super important, and I think they're starting to teach that there.
Yeah, there's definitely a demand for it. But I follow sports a lot, and I like to watch the scores and standings and everything, but I get really intrigued by the stories, and especially like the NFL. What really strikes me is, like you said, there's one destination. You put all of your eggs in one basket, and if you screw up one time at the scouting combine, or you screw something up in a game, that's it. And it's like all of that work is for nothing. I mean, you can lose that gig in a heartbeat. And where do you go? You can't be an entrepreneur NFL player, you know?
It's hard to imagine how you'd make that work. Yeah, I mean, I think that the most successful entrepreneurs always surprise people with how they're able to make connections between specialties. But if you're into sports, and I'm not a huge sports fan, but I heard a podcast that interviewed an NFL player that was back in the days when they had a person on the team that was called a beater. Is that the right term? And they were basically, their purpose was to like beat up the other team's best players. And they were just these big, huge guys that weren't necessarily great at hockey. They were just huge and like good enough. And so they had and I'm going to screw all the terminology up, so please correct me. But when they have like the all-star game, when they just pick the best people from all the teams, you know, they have an audience vote, but I guess it's probably obvious at this point, they don't really listen to what the fans want. They, you know, people in the NHL actually choose the people that make the most sense or that think they're going to sell the most tickets. But this time people decided to be funny and recommend this guy, this huge guy that was like not even necessarily good at playing hockey, never scored a goal in his life, you know, but a massive beat everybody up kind of thing. And he got all the votes because people thought it was funny and it became this huge ordeal. But so this sounds like you don't know the story.
No, I've never heard this story.
Well, it's worth checking out. They did it on I think it was Radiolab, and he winds up getting onto this like all-star team and winds up scoring the two only goals, which were the win goals, and that team won. It's an amazing story and totally defied the odds. And he's one of these kids that like. He obviously was really good at hockey, especially in his local town, but he wasn't Wayne Gretzky either.
Yeah, right.
And so I think that any reasonable person would probably have told him not to put all of his eggs in that basket. And he found his way in making some unusual connections with the type of skills and body type and all that he has. So I would advise anyone that's young, like if you have the spirit for it, you should always go for that home run goal, because it's not all for nothing if you have the spirit for it, because you're never going to forget those experiences and you're going to be able to apply that to what, even if you don't succeed in the way you intended to, you'll always be able to apply that to whatever you wind up doing.
I hear the word specialization running through my mind. And there's a real power in specializing in one thing. Something that kind of irks me about people who are peddling entrepreneurship for musicians is this idea of what do you call it? Diversify, expand your skills into more than one thing. And I think that just kind of weakens you as a musician. It weakens your product. If you are the specialist at playing brass quintet and you're the best at it, then who's the Canadian brass going to call? But if you like diversify so that you can just take any gig that you can, I think that you're weakening yourself. I think there's a lot to be said about being that one trick pony and being the very best at it.
I mean, diversification has its merits. It lowers risk, but it also caps how you can climb. I mean, Elon Musk, imagine if he diversified his investments, you know, according to the Swenson model or something. I don't know. I mean, he wouldn't have a space program. He wouldn't have bought Tesla. He wouldn't have been one of the co-founders of PayPal. You know, there's a lot of things he wouldn't have done. Those are not paths that somebody that wants a diverse investment strategy would do. He went all out, and he's that type. He's an extreme case, but you could think of a million of them. I think at a certain age, if your priorities shift, you know, you might want to consider doing something that's safer, but I don't know. I don't think I'm at that age yet, so I shouldn't be advising what people should be doing at a certain age that I'm not at.
Okay, let's make a little disclaimer here. This podcast is not intended to be legal advice or career advice for anyone, musician or non-musician. Let's just get that out there. All right. Well, okay. So you're in this hyper-focused environment. If you're doing recitals or concerts at Juilliard and you're like playing for the choir, what's it like in that environment versus like your first gig with Canadian Brass, where the audience is like civilians when it comes to music?
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the weird shifts that it smacks you right in the face, because when you're a trumpet player at Juilliard with some of the best trumpeters, and your teacher's a trumpeter, and all your friends are trumpeters, and your audience is trumpeters, you know, or friends of trumpeters, yeah, how how could you not worry about the technique more than the audience? The audience doesn't know what's hard in anything. They don't really care. Only a specialist is gonna, like, let's take the welding example again. Like, somebody that's truly good at welding, they might look at like an old bridge or something and just admire the skills that went into it. But to a normal person, you want a couple of things, and they're very simple. A, you want the bridge not to break. You want to be able to trust that they did their research and that it's engineered properly so you can drive over it safely. And a bonus would be that it looks super cool because it's a pretty massive structure and you don't want it, and it's going to last hopefully a really long time. You don't want it to look horrible. That's it. No one really cares if the person that's welding it has like the greatest technique or the, they just want it to be like, just do it, you know? And it's the same thing with a musician. And a lot of the times in music school, if you are a musician, I'm sure you could probably admit that you're guilty of hyper focusing on your technique. And when you get into the real world, you need to somehow use all that practice and continue to work on your technique, but get past it so that the audience doesn't just hear a show and tell. It's not just look at all this stuff I practiced. You're actually communicating a message, and you're actually able to move them. If you're not able to elicit an emotional response from people, even if it's a negative one, if you're not able to get some emotional response from people, then the technique is literally useless. So that's the difference, I think, that it's almost impossible, even though our teachers say those things, to really believe it until you've experienced it.
So if you're at Juilliard, what gets an emotional response from your classmates, your teachers? Is it like brilliant technique, or is it, what I'm asking, is it basically the same thing, communicating a message to them or the lay people?
The irony of what I'm saying is it actually is the same thing, but it's easier to get lost. So if you're having an audition, let's say a mock audition for, you know, a pretend orchestra, the winner is going to be the person that moved the judges the most.
Well, what moves the judges?
Well, somebody that's able to make you in an orchestral audition, for those that don't know, you're completely blind from the judges. They don't see you and you don't see them. There's literally a curtain separating you. They do this so that there's as little biases that affect their decisions and their listening as possible. And you're playing a small, especially as a trumpet player, a very small section of a huge work, where the trumpet part is usually very insignificant in terms of a large scale piece, but it feels significant, and you're suddenly playing it by itself. And it's sort of the equivalent of a kicker in football. It's a pretty important part, but like in the grand scheme of things, the amount of time that goes into those moments is almost none, nothing. And your job is just to come in and nail it. Now, if you can give the judges, who know these pieces really well, the sensation that they're listening to the full piece, and you get their imagination going so they hear the full orchestra while you're playing, you will have a much better chance of winning. You almost can't win if you don't do that. As opposed to the person that is hyper-focused on technique, what winds up happening is then they listen to your technique, and then they start noticing all sorts of imperfections. So I'm sure that there's parallels with all sorts of – in so many different ways, in so many different fields rather. But so for an orchestral audition, the challenge is to be so solid technically that you're able to move the judges, who just heard a million people play the same thing. And instead of hearing whether it was slightly better than person A or B or C, it reminds them of the real orchestra piece, which is what made them want to be musicians in the first place. And you know what? That's the person we need. And that's how you win.
That's interesting. You have to master the technique. You get it down so much that you're not even thinking about the technique. And then you're concerned with, I don't know, fooling the judge that they're like listening to the entire orchestra, or making them believe that they're listening to the entire orchestra.
Right. You want to get their imaginations just going.
Wow.
You know, it's actually super similar to figure skating in the Olympics, because like orchestral music, it's really an art form that started as an art, and you can make it into a sport like they did with figure skating. Thankfully, that isn't really the case with orchestral trumpet yet. But it's close. it's very close. But, you know, you're watching a beautiful performance. And as a non-professional, you'll watch somebody skate and you're just like, oh, my God, that was unbelievable. I mean, not only is it technically completely impressive, but it was beautiful. But the judges are like, well, you know, their ankle was a little twisted on that landing. That's negative 5 points, you know, and that goes against them. But you'll see it, and it's not common, but when somebody puts on such a beautiful performance that even though that little technical blip is there, it almost goes unnoticed because it didn't affect the performance negatively. Now, the analogy breaks down here, though, because they purposely separate those as separate categories that get weighted a certain way for the Olympics and figure skating. And it's not really quite so formulaic with orchestral trumpet. You know, I've sat. So one of the things that people get eliminated for is having bad time, for example. Like there's a weak sense of pulse. So especially nowadays, there's a lot of music that is beat-based. So we get used to having a very solid beat. So that if the beat's not good, maybe if you're not a musician, you may not know why it doesn't feel right, but it's not going to feel right. And once you hear it feeling right, you're going to be like, that's the one. And I've been behind the screen as a judge listening for somebody deciding who's going to get the job. And there's, you know, six different people. And by the way, there's only one of them that's a trumpet player. It's the principal. And usually then there's the conductor and the violinist and the oboist and a harpist and a pianist, whatever, all these different people that don't really know these trumpet parts as well as the person playing thinks. And they'll do something like tap with their finger to see if the pulse is really that good. And right away, if they think they need to do that, it's not good enough. And that's the sort of irony. And I've seen this happen where there's four different people. They're all tapping to rate in their own minds the time of the person playing. And I'm watching. They're all tapping completely different. And one person's like, time is horrible. You know, X doesn't go on to the next round. And the other person's like, their time is flawless. Absolute pass. It was the most perfect performance. And they're listening to the exact same thing. And so the people that win, though, have such a convincing sense of time that you don't even feel the need to, like when you're listening to a good beat, you're not like, let me see here, one and two and three. No, they're not subdividing. You know, you don't even think about it. It just makes your body want to move. And that's sort of what you're trying to do, not just a beat, but the entire orchestra.
So if you're like with the Canadian Brass and you're playing for civilians when it comes to music, how important is technique? Because like you just said it a couple of minutes ago, like if even if you're not a musician, you know if the music is on and you know if it's not on. So how important is that technique? I mean, is it basically the same thing? You got to have that technique down so that you can communicate the music?
It's sort of both, because on one hand, the technique is one aspect of what makes a performance very powerful. So traditionally, the trumpet parts have always been very flashy because they're sort of – this is sort of the way the treble part tends to be. So in those moments, the technique has to be really perfect. But on the other hand, as a group that, you know, designs their own programs, you can choose to perform music that makes you sound your best. And that's what every group should do. But a lot of the times, groups choose music that they think they should play, and they wind up playing something that is just not making them sound as good. I mean, who wouldn't want to play a piece that sounds harder than it is, and it happens to highlight your strength, your personal strength? The audience can tell that you're not even trying hard. It's just like coming off, and it hits them like a blur. Like, oh my gosh, how'd they do that? You know, and then here's where the analogy with figure skating is different, because it's not a sport. You're not listening to five trumpet players in a row, one after the other, do the same triple axel, and then you're judging the minutiae. The nice thing about a Canadian Brass concert is that we're like, you know what? This particular iteration of the ensemble sounds awesome when they play Toccata and Fugue in D minor. The trumpets sound hot. The tuba sounds great. Whatever. Let's play that. And then people hear it and they're like, whoa, they're not comparing it to, well, last night I heard another group play that piece. And, you know, so there's in that sense, the pressure is taken off, because although the technique is so important, it's not the sole focus of a non-musician to be listening for. And I shouldn't say non-musician, a non-professional musician to be listening for. They came to the concert to be amazed.
Yes.
They want that emotion, as opposed to a judge of a competition where you have to choose a winner and a loser.
Yeah. Well, they have different expectations. So the audience, they're not judging anything. They just want a nice experience, a nice evening out.
Right.
The judges, They want perfection, or as close to it as possible.
Right. Or best. They want best.
I want to talk a little bit about your career with the Canadian Brass. And specifically, I want to ask, how has your perspective changed in the last 10 years? Like, when you won the job, you were 25, 26 years old. Now you're, what are you, 36 now? 35, 36?
Yeah.
34.
So I started when I was 24, which is...
Pretty young.
I was pretty young, and I was feeling the heat. I'll say that.
Describe feeling the heat.
I mean, it was like, I felt like a kid suddenly thrown into the major leagues. It was, even though looking back, I had a pretty straight trajectory. Like, it was as traditional as a music path goes. I went to a music arts high school. I went to LaGuardia. The movie Fame, if you've never seen it, there's a song from the movie Fame. I want to live forever. You know, and actually I'm in the new DVD version. They like pan the orchestra. I was a student. I'm in the orchestra. So I went from that, and then I went to Manhattan School of Music, which is another great conservatory, and then Juilliard, and then got a job in an orchestra, and then Canadian Brass. But it's still, for those that may not know all the in-between, it was a big leap. It was not everybody gets a big break, and that was absolutely a big break. So I think that, you know, we before we hit record, we were talking about ego and all that. And I think that the hardest thing was suddenly I felt like I had to fill the shoes of all the unbelievable people that had come before me in the trumpet section. And in a lot of ways, that sort of did have to happen. But the group was very quick to point out that that isn't the goal. Like, that's not why you get hired. You don't get hired to sound, you know, to fill the shoes of somebody else. They were like, we want you to sound like you. And I think the challenge was that as somebody that was 24, I didn't know exactly what that meant yet. And I'm sure a lot of conservatory level student players that are listening to this can relate, you know. Or let's say if you're in the dating scene, you know, especially if you're younger, the traditional advice is, oh, you just got to be yourself, which is true, but not necessarily good advice, because a lot of the times when you're young, you don't know what that means. And you find out what that means by being in the hot seat and seeing how you react to certain situations and seeing what kind of things you say that people like and what kind of things you say that get awkward reactions or what kind of, and the same thing goes for music. So I had a lot of experimentation to do. And the reason it was high pressure is because these were really high profile events where the group was getting hired for high fees and big concert halls. Like, if you're listening to this and you're not a musician, I'm sure you've heard of Carnegie Hall. We've played there many times. And, you know, that's not the only famous concert hall, but there's many of them. And those are the kind of places we would play. So as a kid, I was basically a kid and suddenly on the main stage having to discover my voice very quickly. So that's what the hot seat felt like to me. So fortunately, I felt technically I was pretty I wouldn't say I was ready, but I was close. And it took me probably about 3 years to feel like I could own it. But it took that long. I would say it took that long.
3 years to not only just get your chops up in shape, but like to feel comfortable in your own skin in that role?
Yeah. I hope it didn't sound like I wasn't uncomfortable, but it didn't feel comfortable until I was playing for 3 years. That's for 3 years from 3 point on, it was like pure fun. But it was like a high ratio of fear and fun for the first 3 years.
Well, I mean, everybody has to go through that, like you just described.
Yeah.
You were just, I don't know, accelerated a little bit because of the really high expectations and the really high level of prestige and previous success of the group. Well, I'm interested in if you were to compare your perspective or your expectations or how you viewed your role, not just as a member of one of the best known classical music ensembles in the world. Compare that when you first got the job to now. And especially, like I said earlier, you're stepping down specifically so you can focus on being a father and being, right, you know, being there for your wife and just being the best man that you can be. So I'm interested in knowing, how has your perspective changed, your expectations of yourself as a performer, musician, human being, then versus now?
Well, I mentioned how much just, you know, playing with the group changed my perspective, because suddenly I wasn't only surrounded by specialists. It was a pretty good cross section of people. It's worth pointing out to those that hadn't been to one of our shows. I did a lot of the not only marketing, because, like, you know, the shows would be marketed by the presenters, but, you know, we would, you know, try to build up our Facebook people and our newsletter and all that stuff. And I was constantly trying to figure out, like, well, who is our audience? Like, who are these people? You know, who are they? And if it's weird that, like, no matter where we go in the world, literally other countries, there was something they all had in common beyond just being our fans that seemed tangible. And yet to this day, I can't really put my finger on it. It's not like we have an age demographic. It's not like there's a, you know, it's not like male or female or any of the traditional demographics. It seems like it spans all ages and races and all that, and political beliefs and all that, which is really fascinating. That's not common, I think, for most groups, especially in classical music. Well, any group, really. So the perspective of getting what I think was a pretty good cross-section of society was something that I'm going to benefit from forever. But nothing changed my perspective more than having kids, because suddenly it wasn't just about me. It gave a meaning to things. And there's a lot of glory in being a musician. And, like, I think a lot of orchestral musicians don't feel, depending on their original motive, fully satisfied, because you'll play a piece as a principal trumpet player that has some of the most glorious moments ever, and then you'll meet somebody in the street, you know, the next day that'll say, oh, I didn't even know there was trumpet in orchestra, you know? And you're like, man, I'm like Michael Jordan of the New York Philharmonic, you know, but you don't even know this trumpet in the orchestra. I don't even know there was people that played basketball. It's like that. So it's hard to, if you were in it for the glory, even just a little bit, there really isn't that much of it in the orchestra, because short of students that are going to admire what you do, the audience barely, you know, they're not listening to you that closely. So Canadian Brass wasn't like that. We were totally stars. We get to, we play for, we sign autographs for an hour after every show. You know, we would, depending on the country, we would sometimes leave and, you know, customs officers would recognize us. I mean, it was pretty amazing. And I don't think I ever just expected that type of publicity. Although I, looking back, I always wanted it. I wanted to be a soloist, and I think that was probably part of the reason. And it's great. So it's a real ego blaster. And what having kids, though, did is made me realize, like, you know what? I'm going to miss that. That was awesome. But it's not the number one most important thing to me. And I don't know if it was ever the most important thing to me. I think music was always number one. And then performing, the love of just being on stage, performing, that interaction was always second. But I love both. Now it's like family is definitely first. Music would be very close second. No, I shouldn't say very close second, but it would be in that order. Family and then music itself. Like, I'd be very happy just studying, performing, playing music completely in isolation. And then that love of performing is there too. So I need sort of all three, but that's the order that's changed.
Where did family fall in when you first got the job? You didn't have a family then.
I didn't. Yeah. When I thought family, I thought of my parents and my siblings, and I love my family, and not everybody is as fortunate as I've been to have that closeness with them. But no matter what I say, my decisions show my priorities. You know, I was leaving home very early. I moved out when I was 17, not in a fit of rage, just because it was a good opportunity. I moved to Manhattan. I had my own apartment. I was still in high school. It was awesome, you know? And so I always just – it was like obvious. Everyone – it was just sort of like an unwritten rule. Everyone knew that if some cool music opportunity came up, I was going to take it. I wasn't even going to ask permission from my family. That was just what it was. Getting married was a big change, because suddenly I was like, you know, I can't just like ignore my wife, you know.
Yeah. That doesn't work out too well.
It doesn't work out. And of course, she was very supportive and she could always come. That was the difference. It wasn't really – didn't really feel like I had to choose. And she got to benefit – even though it was challenging, but we would have concerts in Hawaii. So then we'd go to Hawaii. I got to take her to Hawaii for free. That was pretty cool. And other great places. But with kids, First of all, they don't really enjoy traveling to Hawaii because they're babies and it's expensive and it's crazy and you don't sleep on the plane. It's just not the same fun. So logistically, it doesn't make sense. But the reality is, it's like nothing gives me the joy. And I never would have known this without having kids. But just being able to pick up my kids is hands down the greatest thing ever. I feel like it, as proud as I am of all the amazing success I've had in music, like I'm very fortunate, lucky, proud, all of those emotions. And they're really, really, really strong. And they were the most strong emotions I had until having kids. And it literally trumps that by so much that I don't even know how to put a number value to it. What, 1,000 times better? I don't know. It's that much better.
I think I read a couple of months ago on ESPN. I'm a sports fan, so I use a lot of sports analogies. You're not a sports fan. That's fine. We forgive you. But I was reading a story about an NFL player, and I don't know if you can relate to this, but basically his story was that, you know, he won the gig with, the Seattle Seahawks or something 10 years ago. He's right out of college, 22 years old, maybe 23 years old. Now he's 32, 33, and he's talking about how his perspective has changed over the years. Like, when he first came into the NFL, you know, what a big deal. You know, you're playing in front of 60,000 people every week, and, you know, you got all that pressure to basically win the approval of the coaches and whatever. But now he's 32, 33, he's married, he's got a couple of kids, and he's just saying after a while it just becomes a battle for survival. And he's not thinking about the challenge of, I mean, you get the gig in the NFL and then you have to win the gig in the NFL, just like a musician, right? You get the gig and then you got to win your section mates over, the music director over. You got to win the gig after you get it. And it's kind of like that in the NFL. And he's just saying after 10 years, man, it's just a matter of survival. I'm not worried about the glory anymore. I'm just worried about not getting killed. I wonder if you can relate to that at all.
Yeah, I can. I mean, I think it's less dangerous, so I'm not worried about it. It's not survival in the same sense, but yeah. I mean, when you see somebody do something like an NFL athlete, like a star athlete or a star musician or anybody that's doing something on the best of their field. Anything, science, whatever it is, they are likely putting basically 100% into that. Mm-hmm. And something else has to suffer. If you're single and young and you're a student and you want and you aspire to goals like that, that's awesome. And I've been that person, and it was so worth it to experience life at that depth, because you get out of life and individual moments of life what you put into it, you know? So the glory, just to speak of the glory, yeah. Playing for 60,000 people, most people don't know what that's like. I've never played for 60,000 people, but I've played for 20,000 people, and it was like, you feel invincible. It's amazing.
Where did you play for 20,000 people?
We played for, you know, it wasn't full. I might be pushing it, but it was huge. As a trumpet player, I'm not supposed to play for 20,000 people. You know, it was at the Key Arena in Seattle. Oh. We played for, it was like a Lions Club meeting. So we played a mini concert there. We've played more often. It was for crowds. You know, our normal crowd size would probably be about 1,000 to 3,000. But for a couple of shows, we've played for like 7,000 to 10,000 people. And that's like, if we only played shows for people for like 10,000 to 30,000 people, I don't know. That might have been a different. It would have been different somehow. I don't know what it would be different, but it'd be different. It's a different thrill. Not everyone likes that. I love it. And but it takes so much work for 30,000 people. You know, imagine this guy that's in the NFL to be somebody that 30,000 people want to pay money to go see that. Something has to give, and you become more aware that you have to decide if you're really willing to put that much into it, if the glory is worth it. And for some people it is, and that's – I'm not going to judge them. I mean, if you're Chance the Rapper, I think a couple of weeks ago announced that he was canceling tours because he had a second kid. And I was blown away because he made a big deal about it. I mean, these are people that paid hundreds of dollars for a ticket and, you know, probably arena type places. And, you know, I'm sure all the presenters that had all these shows lined up, or all the promoters, are not happy. They don't care how you had a kid, you know. There's a lot of money on the line for that stuff. But he was like, well, sorry, you know, I missed a week of my daughter's, you know, second week of life, and I missed some of the major milestones, and I'm never going to get those back. So I'm not going to let that happen. And it was like on the news, you know, that Chance the Rapper did that. And I thought that was so cool. And I think times are changing. I think that's more acceptable. Fans are like, wow, he's a human being. But like Frank Sinatra, I mean, and I'm not an expert at his life, but man, they would go on tour for months in another country. Now you don't really have to do that because planes are bad or for some reason. But still, you know, he dedicated everything, and he reaped the rewards. He was a star, and he'll go in the history book. He's in the history books. But so I think that what I can relate to is that you just sort of don't necessarily want to put that first.
Yeah.
So, and it's not forever. I imagine maybe I'll want to tour forever and do whatever I can to figure out how to be in front of 30,000 people. I think that I might want that, but maybe I'll change around. I have no idea. But all I know is that right now I want, you know, I'm sad that right now I'm in Alabama without my kids, because at least it's only for 3 days though.
What do you plan for the concert?
The big piece is Brahms' Second Symphony.
Okay.
So it's a totally different stress, by the way. So Canadian Brass Show as the star, you get to have your personality shine. You get to choose the pieces. You get to phrase it in the way that makes you look and sound the best. And it's now the conductor's the boss. I'm playing one tiny thing and I mostly sit there, and it's either like you ruin it or you don't get noticed, you know. And I sympathize with orchestral trumpet players because it's like, that's it. There's very few pieces where you're the star. And we've played those too, like Mahler Symphony, and we've played Mahler 5 here before. And then it's pressure, but it's like, yeah, but you get to play. And then is Brahms too, where you're that person in the background that has to play something that's very hard and scary, but you don't notice it unless it gets destroyed.
You either screw it up or you're ignored.
Or you're ignored. But the music is so glorious that it's so worth it.
Was there a moment where it just hits you like, okay, it's time to leave Canadian Brass?
I think it kind of came to a point. I'm making this sound like that I've been pondering it like in a bad way. I mean, I would come back from tours and be like, oh my God, that was so much fun. Mm-hmm. And then like we'd have a couple of weeks at home and I'd be like, oh my God, I can't believe I have to leave town for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it was that. And those the extremes of the emotions were really, really wearing on me. And I don't think I even really admitted it, because then I'd go on tour and it was like, this is awesome. And then I'd come home and talk about how great it was. And I'd see that my wife's eyes are bloodshot. Be like, oh, I don't really want to hear about how much fun you had for the last 3 weeks, because, you know.
And she's like, that's nice, honey. Can you take out the trash?
Right. I'm like, oh, man, I just signed like 80 autographs. And yeah, exactly. And it's not fair. It wasn't fair to her, and it wasn't fair to them. And so I think that, and then of course, and this is not just about me. I mean, Brandon Ridenour, who got me the job in the Canadian Brass 10 years ago, is at a point in his life where he's been developing his own solo projects with a ton of success. He's extremely talented. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows he's a ridiculous trumpet player.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he is in the point of his life that we both were in when we were both in the group together, where he is going to give the group 100%. Like, that's his project right now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a disservice to our fans to not have him doing that. So, and the last thing I want to do is get in the way of that momentum. So I don't think I would have really let it get in the way, but I think I was coming to a point mm-hmm. where I was finally admitting that I was going to have to choose. And so I'm so excited for the fans to have Brandon back. I mean, he's amazing. He really is truly amazing. One of the most talented people I know. And it's just sort of cool to have it all come full circle.
Chris, you have given us a lot to think about, as always. Deep thinker. And I appreciate you sharing your knowledge and your experiences with Juilliard and the Canadian Brass and being a husband, a father. And I get the impression that you're at peace with your decision.
Very much so. I should mention that a lot of my students, so I teach at Ithaca College, and that's another responsibility that I wanted to be faithful to. One of my trumpet students came up to me after I wrote that email that you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast and said, yeah, I want to congratulate you on, be the first to congratulate you on your retirement.
And I was like, retirement.
Thanks. However, I like the way that sounds. I like thinking that I just, you know, like an athlete, I'm retiring at 34, but yeah, I'm not quite retiring, and I'm also not never going to perform again. I have tons of concerts coming up, including some. I have a bunch of solo projects that have just been on the back burner a little bit too long, and so keep an eye out for those.
Nice.
I have a single out that if you want to check out, it's sort of like I'm new to doing all this and doing it through CD Baby, so it's sort of probably not the easiest thing to find. Although it is on my blog.
It's Trumpet Chris blog.
Yeah, .com. And if you go on, I have a lot of articles on there, but the single is easy to find if it's on there. It's a really cool piece by Nils Fromm. He's a German musician. He kind of fits in the ambient slash kind of classical class. You know, it's hard to kind of pigeonhole him, but I just transcribed it. I thought it was beautiful. Before my first son was born, he seemed to react positively to the piece in the womb. So I transcribed it for him. So it was kind of cool to finally record it. So I'm actually going to do a music video for that eventually. So
TrumpetChrisBlog.com.
Yeah.
Well, man, we got to do this again sometime.
Let's do it.
And you're just the word just came to me, balance. Like you're stepping away from this great gig, but you've got all these other things that probably are going to be just as fulfilling at the end of the day. And you still got attention to your wife and your kids and everything. So I have to say congratulations.
Thank you. I'm a lucky guy.
Trumpet Dynamics is produced by Beaten Path Media, LLC. Special thanks to Mike Vax for allowing use of Serenade to a Bus Seat for the show's theme music. To stay in the loop with the growing community of trumpeters who enjoy this podcast, just type trumpetdynamics.com in your browser and you're off to the races. My name is James Newcomb and I'm your host. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.